Today's episode is sponsored by Cambridge Life Insurance. When I left my corporate job in 2015, there was a lot on my mind. Not only was I wondering what I'd do if I'd made the right decision and if I had the funds to do so, I had another worry. As a sole breadwinner, were the right safety nets in place to protect my wife Lisa and daughter Soraya, who was one at the time? I needed to get the right life insurance policy that accounted for my transition into entrepreneurship and our aspirations to grow our family. At first, I called a few insurance companies and got quotes directly from their websites. It was confusing, tedious, and I couldn't make sense of the pricing. Around that time, I was introduced to Kenny and the team at Cambridge Life Insurance. They made the process seamless, transparent, and since I was already parallel processing with the traditional carriers, I had proof that they were actually cheaper. They were so committed to the customer experience that Kenny hunted me down in Brooklyn, covered in sweat, so I could lock in my policy less than 24 hours before we got on a plane to Bali with a one-way ticket. And as an insurance agent, Cambridge works for the client, not the insurance company, so I knew my interests were fully aligned. Whether you're a newlywed, new parent, or new business owner, contact Cambridge Life Insurance for a complimentary assessment on personal or life insurance planning. Visit bit.ly/gocamlife. That's bit.ly/gocamlife. Welcome to the Rad Awakenings podcast. I'm Kay Hee. When was the last time you became aware of something deep, provocative, and uncomfortable? In these moments, we level up in our work, our creativity, and most importantly, in our own heads. Each episode, our guests will describe their rad awakenings. The conversations are real, raw, and will share in both struggle and joy. Today marks the end of the first season of Rad Awakenings, and what better way to end the podcast with one of our favorite guests, Tiago Forte. He's the founder of Forte Labs, an education company centered around two of my favorite topics, productivity and learning. Tiago and I love geeking out on our workflows and note-taking systems, but it wasn't until this episode that I found a deeper commonality. We both truly believe that sharing knowledge with our communities is one of life's greatest privileges. Tiago believes that technology has completely changed the way we work as knowledge workers or as entrepreneurs. We talk about new multi-billion dollar industries that are being created each year, which creates openings for anyone to become an expert. And what is expertise anyways when things are changing so quickly? Tiago explains how you can productize knowledge as a consultant, blogger, writer, or business owner. Our conversation is filled with pragmatic ways to test how the new economy can work for you and give you the freedom to blaze your own trail. Please enjoy my conversation with Tiago Forte. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Rad Awakenings podcast. We've got our favorite guest, Tiago Forte. How's it going, man?
Really good, really good. Glad to be back and to continue our epic conversations.
I know. It's crazy. This is the 52nd episode. So 52 what? Weeks ago. Yeah. You were the first one.
Oh my gosh. I love how you just played it cool. Like, I think I'll just try a couple podcast episodes and then you just like destroy it.
So slow play or obsessively anxious and never satisfied. But maybe we'll come back to that at the end. So for brief context, I think many of our listeners will remember those, but you walk to a social event outside of, you know, your tight group of friends and your people, your tribe, and someone asks you, "Hey man, what do you do? How do you answer that?"
Oh, gosh. It really depends on so many things. It depends so much that I don't know if I've ever said the same thing twice. If I don't really want to get into it, I'll say I run a media and training company. If I really don't want any follow-up questions, I'll just say I'm a teacher.
And what if the person seems interesting and inquisitive and you want to bait him or her for a longer conversation?
Yeah, then I find it's usually more interesting to sort of talk about the category or the arena in which I'm working rather than like the particular kind of company, which is sort of irrelevant. It actually depends kind of on their interests. If I happen to know they're in productivity, I'll say, yeah, we're trying to reinvent the future of work. I work in a company that we're trying to reinvent what it means to be productive in the 21st century. Or sometimes if it's more towards learning, I'll say we are a company reinventing what it means to learn or reinventing learning. Those are sort of the dual pillars, I guess, of the company, productivity and learning. And I often find if there's a glint in their eye or they kind of get taken aback, then it usually means there's a fruitful conversation to be had.
Oh, boy. You're seeing through the mic of the twinkle and glint in all of our listeners' eyes. So why don't we do this? If you could vaguely dial back the clock a year ago, so June, May, June-ish of 2017, I had only one kid, which is crazy at the time. What were the manifestations of this productivity and learning?
You mean for me personally or for the company?
For the company. Products being the more trite term that I was trying to evade.
Totally. Products and content. So a year ago, we were in the midst of, I think we were just about to start the third cohort of our course, Building a Second Brain. And that has grown, that was launched the first round, the first cohort in January of 2017, which is just insane to me. But that's really become our flagship course. It encompasses most or many of the topics that we cover. It's the most innovative, most important, most impactful of the courses that we offer. And that has evolved. So it went through four live cohorts, where we would deliver the course live to a group of between 50 and 100 people at a time. And just a couple months ago, it became self-paced. So now the price is cheaper because it's less interactive and more about the content. But it's something you can now, actually, since we last talked, you can now enroll in the course at any time, and it's just $399. We're about to launch a new tier and kind of split the course into a premium and a lower tier. So I would act on that now while you still get all the features.
Amazing. And we'll put it in the show notes. And I will disclaim that in the past, I have been an affiliate of the course, but it's always very well described. So you've been in the online learning course world for a while, right? Is that fair?
I really have. In fact, my very first, before I even thought I wanted to start a company, this was the summer of 2013 when I left the consulting job that I had come to San Francisco to do right around June of 2013. And I just thought, you know, I had very little savings and practically no runway, but I thought, let me just try to take on a couple projects before I look for a job again. And then the very first thing I did was an online course. It was on the GTD, Getting Things Done method, which I think you may be a little familiar with.
Well, I've had a dalliance with it.
Yeah, it was just being on Skillshare, which was the platform at the time, and seeing that these courses were just not very good and selling tens of thousands in some cases of tickets. And I just thought I could do something like that. And I used the content from the GTD book and I made a series of videos, and that course is around to this day.
Wow.
5 years later, I still have maybe a handful of sales a week, which just is completely mind-blowing and also a testimonial to the power of a productized piece of knowledge like that.
And would you say that you added a lot of unique, like your own insight into there? Or was it just like, here's like physics, here's GTD, and I have a way of teaching it in that original course?
You know, it's funny. I wouldn't say there's that much original.
Yeah.
I mean, GTD is a finely, you know, well-oiled machine.
Yep.
It's proven. It had been, even at that point, been around for 15 or 20 years. And my goal was not to make myself into a thought leader. I didn't even know what a thought leader was at that point. All I wanted was to be able to send my friends or people I knew or the people on Skillshare this, you know, $20 course, $25 course, and have them learn and benefit how I benefited.
Yeah.
Wow. And by the way, I'm a huge, huge evangelist, by the way, of people creating online courses.
Okay.
I mean, I'm more of an evangelist for that happening than even people buying my own products and services.
Wow. Like,
it is an enormous priority for me. And that's an important point, I think, to notice is you don't necessarily even have to have your own content.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, just look around you. What have you benefited from? And you may need to ask for permission or maybe, you know, check what the rules are, but just repurpose it and turn it into a different format. And you'll learn more in that process than you ever learned just consuming.
That is, wow. Okay. So that's the first knowledge bomb of this podcast, but maybe to play like a little bit devil's advocate or skeptic, there's so many crap courses out there. And I think productivity is one where it's particularly pernicious. I guess the first question is, do you agree with that statement? Like bad classes out there?
Oh yeah, definitely.
And I guess the second question, which is maybe a little bit more nuanced, is, and I know that our audience would be asking this, like, what gives you, Tiago, you, Kay, the permission, the authority to represent yourself as the authority in this thing called, you know, say productivity?
Yeah, the chutzpah, right? It's yeah. Like, who are you?
Exactly. We're just some dudes on the internet, man.
I know. You know, this, it's such an interesting question because it goes to the heart of everything from like hierarchies. Mm-hmm. Who deserves to be in charge?
Yeah.
Who deserves to be at the top of the ladder, to income scales? Why do two people doing the same job? Why can one of them make twice as much or way more than another? I mean, all these questions that are pretty fundamental to how we work and live.
Yeah.
And I think what it comes down to with online teaching and online learning is that there's a few things, actually. So one is the best teacher is a recent novice.
Best teacher is a recent novice. Okay.
So there's this well-known phenomenon, which is called the curse of knowledge or the curse of the expert or expert blindness, which is, you know, we tend to look to people who are the most knowledgeable, who are the biggest experts. But the thing with expertise is that it blinds you. It blinds you to, it kind of gets you lost in the weeds of the details and the subtleties, which are fascinating to you. Mm-hmm. But you often, it's very easy to overlook the basics, which is what someone just entering the field needs. Because to you, you know, they're so far in your past that you don't even remember a time when you didn't know them.
Does that hold true, though, for quantum physics or something? Like, that must not always be the case, right?
You know, I don't, it depends on it's sort of the purpose of teaching. You know, if you're in a PhD class at Harvard, sure.
Yeah.
Like you want, you know, the guy whoever the person was that discovered quantum physics. But let's say if you're just getting into quantum physics, you don't want to take an online course on Coursera from that Harvard professor. He's probably terrible at explaining it, to be honest.
Yeah.
Tim Urban talks about this, how, you know, he writes those huge book-sized blog posts.
Yep, yep.
That then become viral all over the internet. He says his goal when entering a field is just to get to a 6 out of 10 in terms of knowledge, because then he is competent at having conversations with true experts. But the thing is, most people are not even there. They're just trying to get to level 1 or 2 or 3. And for that purpose, I'd say it's better to, you know, when you were recently a novice, you have empathy. You remember what it was like to enter this new domain where you didn't know anything, any of the terminology. So when you turn around and then teach it, you're much more empathetic. You explain things more simply. You're more patient. You simplify things instead of complexify them.
So that's one advantage of being inexperienced or not needing the expertise to teach. What are some other reasons that it's okay to be an online teacher?
Yeah, I think another one is the kind of splintering fragmentation of traditional disciplines. Best example is cryptocurrency. I actually remember, so 5 years ago when I was at that previous job, we worked out of a co-working space. And there was this guy there, I'll never forget it, where just when Bitcoin was getting big, he and a partner had a startup working on, I can't remember what it was, but it wasn't really going anywhere. And he just decided, you know what, I'm going to become the expert in cryptocurrency. He had no background. He had a tech background, kind of standard, you know, engineering background. But then he just went on this rampage where just for a period of maybe 2 months, he read everything he could find, which at the time, of course, wasn't much. It was a few white papers. It was a few books on like economics, law, philosophy, contracts. And I'll never forget, like 2 months later, I see him on TV and he's being interviewed as this like this crazy Bitcoin expert. And today, I think he's on even a higher trajectory where, you know, if you have five years of experience in crypto, you actually are an expert.
That's what blows me away about crypto. And I don't have like a a view on. I think it's going to be big, but that's probably all I can say. And I definitely don't have an investment view on it. But it started in 2009, I think, in earnest. So it's been around for 8 years. If you took a year of your life from 2018 to 2019, you would have been dedicated to 10% of the entire life of something that could be transformative to society. There's nothing else that you can do that in, that I know of today. 10% for a year.
Right. Yeah, we tend to be feel like we're victims of change because we, you know, invest in a degree or a certificate or a profession and it changes. I mean, the upside of that is just as real, which is when with a new multi-billion dollar industry being born every year. I mean, think about it. It's chatbots 1 year, and then it's VR, and then it's AR, and then it's drones, and then it's CRISPR genetic engineering, and then it's just one thing after another. That means that you just need to get one infinitesimal 0.01% of that industry, and you can make a fortune, or at the very least, a very successful career.
Yeah. Do you think that someone could go from knowing, I'll pick drones because I think they're cool and I know nothing about them. If I immersed myself in drones for a year, then I could create an online course in a year and be deserving of people paying for it?
Oh, no question. Here's the important point, though, is it has to be real. It has to be interactive immersion. And what I often see is people, they'll immerse themselves even, but it'll be in consumption. So they'll be reading book after book, online article after online article, even taking course after course. No. Because that has no competitive advantage. Anyone can do that and they will. What I would say for, let's just take drones as an example, go to the offices, like call up some of the drone makers and see if you can visit them. Go to Maker Faire. Go to these free meetups where people are just like crashing drones into things or having drone battles, these like illicit warehouse races where they like rate, like go, it's almost like you're a journalist, go on scene and get your hands as dirty as possible, because the most valuable knowledge in any field is not found online. It's hidden knowledge. It's found in bars. It's found in people's living rooms as they're having conversations. It's found in private Slack channels. There's a parallel to like investment advice. By the time it's hit like the front page of Bloomberg, there's no value. I mean, that's an exaggeration. It's not that there's no value, but man, it's not novel.
And you're so right. The rate of change, you know, and again, like look at you and I, right? We're in content, right? With like a little C, maybe you with a big C. But I mean, for me, it's been 2 years and I can't say I can hang with the best in content, but like I'm in the conversation. Like I'm definitely a six.
Yes.
And
yes.
You know, full on immersion though, right? That's, you know, you and I have been, you've been blogging much longer than me, but it's been writing like every day for God knows, like for years now. We got the expertise. We're drone experts. We're immersed for a year. What's the next step to like turn it into a product with paying customers?
Great question. I actually recommend an intermediate stage, which is offering it as a service. So making it into a service first for many, many reasons. One is you can, because it's personalized and sort of, you know, high touch, you can charge a premium price.
What do you mean by, can we keep running with the drones example?
Yeah, definitely. So I'd say, you know, once you're immersed in the field, what is the biggest need people have? Maybe it's like understanding the laws around how and where drones can be used, say, in a given city. Like that might be a big thing. Like every time you want to fly a drone, you got to know, okay, well, what city am I in? What are the laws here? Am I going to get, you know, in trouble, arrested, what? So then you fill that need. You could eventually make a product around that, you know, an online course on laws of drone navigation. Who knows? Or a book.
That's probably actually a pretty good business.
Right? No, that will be a huge business, like eventually, you know, it just will be. There's too much at stake. But I'd say you only want to productize. And I've made this mistake. I can talk about it, actually. If you make it into a product too early before you've validated the need and the audience and the framing, then once it's a product, it's sort of fixed, right? You're not going to go and re-record and redo the whole thing. So it kind of is what it is. So that's why you want to start with a service. The beauty of a service is it can be changed every single iteration. One day you can offer a workshop on understanding drone laws. And then, you know, in the feedback forms that evening, be like, oh my gosh, this doesn't work. Actually, it needs to be more like consulting. And the next day, go out and do consulting one-on-one. It's extremely easy to pivot. And you can change your message. If all you have is a website where you're describing a service, you can change that website every day until you find your fit.
So service is basically trading time for money, right? Being a consultant, effectively.
Yes. Yeah. As Paul Graham says, you know, his recommendation to early stage startups is do things that don't scale, right? Because that's where the learning and adaptation comes in.
Okay. So that's our intermediate step. But question for you on the intermediate step. How does one get clients? You're like 3 months into becoming a drone law expert.
Yeah.
Who's going to pay for the service?
Yeah. I mean, that's actually the first and most important thing you need to validate. Because coming back to your point of there's so many crappy online courses, that's because by far the hardest part in the entire process of creating online courses is selling them, right? It's so much easier to create. It's so much harder to market an online course than it is to create one. So, you know, you have all these people creating them, but then actually making any money at all is a different proposition. And that's why you want to be sure. I mean, by the time you start actually building your content for your course, you need to be certain that there is a ready and willing audience, willing to pay, able to pay, dollars in hand. Otherwise, you just can't justify the investment. So I can give an example on that. My fiance and partner, Lauren, is in the midst of launching her online course. And this is a fantastic example because it's super niche. So there's this government program that pays for U.S. citizens to go abroad for an academic year and do research or teach. It's called the Fulbright Fellowship. Super prestigious, really amazing opportunity. Because it's prestigious, a lot of people just assume they will never be able to do it. So she did hers in Brazil 8 years ago, had such a transformative experience. Over the following year, she started coaching people for free. Right. She was a TA at UC Berkeley, and she would just, you know, a grad student in one of her courses would be like, I'd love to do a Fulbright. She'd be like, okay, I'll meet with you once a week for a few weeks and coach you through the whole process of applying. She did that with probably a dozen people completely for free.
Just out of sheer love for the product or what it stood for.
Yeah. And specifically, her passion is making it available to people who are underprivileged or people of color. Most fellowship applicants tend to be from like the Ivy Leagues, tend to have a broad experience already, tend to speak, you know, different languages. It's like, it's an elite thing that doesn't have to be because it's our tax money. It's just sitting there waiting for us to access, right? She did that for free for years and finally was just like, why don't I make a course out of this? And I think it was seeing me kind of behind the scenes do all my stuff that kind of made it seem more feasible. But actually, we did some research. There is no other existing online course on how to apply for a Fulbright.
Makes sense, yeah.
Right?
Makes sense, but doesn't, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a sizable market, and they're going to pay, you know, $400 to $700 to get a personalized coaching program, including like mock interviews, including feedback on resumes, including editing. It's like a really huge value for what's being offered. So I'd invite your listeners to just look around them. Look at the niches that exist completely untapped that in the past would not have been profitable to have a course at your local college. But because of the internet, you can reach, you know, how many billion, 2 billion people, 3 billion people through the web now suddenly become
and
viable.
Her initial set of customers was just through word of mouth from just being in that community. Was there blogging or paid acquisition?
Yeah, so that's a great point too, is in the beginning, it can be very personalized. So, I mean, at this point, she's just going to other TAs at UC Berkeley. She's going to her professors. She's, you know, in Slack groups and Facebook groups and other forums specifically for, you know, UC students or UC Berkeley students. She's tapping her personal network first, which is where it always starts. And then eventually she'll move on to, you know, bigger communities, or she'll maybe even, you know, it's kind of related in the realm of professional development and professional growth. So maybe she'll speak at a UC commencement, or she'll go to a conference on professional training, or there's really limitless opportunities.
And so contrary to the popular belief, it's not just start a blog, be active on Twitter. That's one pathway.
Yeah, I think you need to have free offerings. I mean, there's pretty much no way around it. The blog is the traditional way. But for someone to drop hundreds of dollars on a stranger they met online, you have to prove upfront for free that you can create value. Yeah, social media is one way. I don't know if Twitter by itself, I think you could maybe pique interest or hook people into visiting your website. But I think at some point you need either blog posts or a free course or free. I mean, there's many ways to do this too. You have a free, you know, downloadable PDF. The Kindle ebook publishing process is incredibly easy, and I'm becoming a huge proponent of like anyone who has anything to say should just publish an ebook because it's so frictionless.
Okay, so we were in the intermediate phase of our legal drone analysis, and then you see that there's willing customers. What's the next step?
Yes, so let's say you have, 10 people, from individuals, hobbyists, to startups, to companies, that for some sort of exchange of value, this is Eric Ries's point, is there needs to be some exchange, right? You don't want to work totally for free. Maybe they give you their time, they give you their testimonial, like there should be something you're getting in return. You use those first 10 people as a test, right? So maybe you put together a very kind of basic version of your online course, send it to those 10 people, and ask them, is this something that you're interested in? Or does this capture a lot of the value that I provided you as a service? And because you have relationships with these 10 people, they'll often be willing to tell you. Another thing I really, really highly recommend, like really early on in the process, is to start an email list. Honestly, day one, add your mom to it, add your sister, your spouse, and your dog.
The luckiest thing I ever did was start an email list while I was still working in finance. Not by strategy. It was completely accidental.
Yeah. I mean, you just don't know. You don't know what's going to happen, who you're going to come across, especially if you go through that immersion process that we described. Anyone you meet at a conference or a coffee shop or on the street or over the phone, you can just say, hey, the number of phone calls and Skype calls that I end with, hey, you mind if I add you to my email list? And I will go and add them manually because, there's this interesting thing where with social networks, it's been shown that the really powerful parts of your social network are the weak ties, the loose ties.
I was just writing about this today.
Yeah, it's not the first connection, the first order connections, which is people who, they're your fans or your family or your friends. They know what you're doing anyway. It's like two or three or four jumps away that really could bring you new opportunities. The thing is with those people, you're never going to be able to keep in touch with them on a one-to-one basis. Right. So it's like with an email list where they can essentially sign on to stay updated with you passively. The commitment they're making is not a phone call or something that takes half an hour or an hour. It's just getting an email once in a while. It's like the scope or the span of people that you can maintain some connection with is increased by one or two orders of magnitude.
Totally. And not only that, but they leap you into completely new social networks or networks.
Exactly.
Like what's one more Yale graduate going to add to my penetration of my social network personally? It's low.
Exactly. And then you can use MailChimp for this, or another simpler one that MailChimp owns is called Tiny Letter, which is a great option. But you think, well, what do I send? Just send out personal updates. Here's where I traveled. Here's a book I read. Just start with anything. And that actually starts building that muscle of like, I have something to say. And, some people won't like what you have to say and they'll unsubscribe, whatever. But some people will be like, I love getting your weekly emails. They just give a little, drop of joy in my weekend. You're just like, whoa, like what I had to say actually had value for this person.
Wow. Okay. And so I guess maybe I'll pause you here because one thing I want to, maybe if you zoom up a bit and you're like, these are the skills that I didn't realize I had or had to learn on the fly. Like if you really take a 10,000 foot view of what enables what you've built to exist, do you have a sense of what some of those skills are?
I think to a certain extent, it's a mystery to me. There is definitely something to the basic drive. The drive in my case it all starts with writing. The fundamental unit of progress in my world is blog posts. Each one is this thing that drops, especially since mine tend to be, they're longer and kind of more substantive. Like each one is trying to advance something.
They're like research papers.
They really are more like research papers. Yeah. I joke that I have a biological clock, but it's like it is since last blog post.
I love that.
And I can feel in my bones, when it's been too many days. Gosh, I hate to say it, but there's something about like the passion and just the love of the craft and love of the topic. Where I'm sure I would be doing pretty much the same thing, even if it made no money. I'd be, probably have to have a job, but be doing it on the weekends and in the evenings because I just care so freaking much that the thinking around productivity and how to get work done is advanced.
I'll add a few that I've observed in myself, and I think you have many of these as well. One is writing, but I think it's less the output of writing. Writing, it's like one thing to say, I know this concept in my head, and it's another thing to explain it on a piece of paper, and it's a third thing to explain it to a group of people in real life.
Yeah.
And so I would say writing is definitely the fuel, and I wasn't an English major. I only started writing 3 years ago. That would be one thing. I think that a few that I've slowly started to discover is storytelling, kind of building narrative arcs, setting tension in your writing. And I write more emotive work than your pieces, but I really, like, I spend so much time on my first paragraph. It's like, what's the thing that everyone can say, I've been there before? And I just ruminate over that all week.
Mm-hmm.
And then it could get more extreme, like writing good headlines, which like really, really matters. I hate that it matters, but it matters. But again, that's a skill, right? That we talked about this in the first podcast, is compression. A headline is the most compressed piece of language in a blog or in a newspaper. And then this other one that I've just started to gain appreciation for is design. And simple things like how to pair colors, what fonts work together, how to take a good picture. And these are like really simple things. Like for a picture, it's just the thirds in your viewfinder. I'm a little late to find this out. But if you match the photo, the subject, to one of those thirds, the mind naturally goes there.
Yeah.
And just finding out what those things are in design really makes things stick out, in my opinion. And it's part of like branding. It's visually appealing. And so those would be like some of the things that I've kind of picked up along the way.
Yeah, it's the universal principles underlying all of art, all of creativity.
Whether you're a drone maker, drone regulator, or self-improvement blogger, product, it matters. And I'm convinced, because you and I see the back end of how people respond to things. I usually have a decent intuition around what's well-designed. Okay, so my next question for you then is, you've turned this into, in the year that you've been at this, you've turned this into a full-blown, you use our a lot, our company, the team. How has this gone from kind of being really like a business of one to a business, like a business of many?
Yeah, it has. It has really over that year time frame. And this is kind of the frontier of where I'm at and something I'm thinking a lot about. Really, it happened pretty organically where around the summertime, I hired a course manager. His name was Ben, to kind of help me handle the load of the cohort, because it was quite a bit larger than previous ones.
Question for you on Ben.
Yeah.
Have you ever met Ben in real life?
So when I hired him, I had not. I had met him, I don't even remember, through some combination of social media and the blog. A few months later, I did fly him out here from Pittsburgh to San Francisco to come hang out, which was really fun, really cool.
So you hired Ben. Does Ben have a full-time job? Or is this his full-time job?
No. So no one I work with works for me, and none of them work full-time with me. Still, and really by design. I never want anyone to work full-time for me, because for a lot of reasons. I mean, I never want to feel like someone is waiting for me to give them something to do. I want to be one of many, essentially, clients that they're working for, where as soon as I'm not holding up my end of the bargain in terms of, you know, being in communication and updating them, then they have other things that they can turn to. It's actually really good accountability. But at the time, he was, I think, in between jobs. Now he's really grown into what I think of as a full stack freelancer. Which really my long-term goal, and I'm very explicit about this, for everyone that works with me and for me, is for each of them to become full-stack freelancers, for my work with them to be just one item in a portfolio that encompasses many different kinds of income streams.
But what if they just love what you and Forte Lab stands for?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Everyone that's, so we're 10 now, there's 10 total. And every one of them, probably just a natural filtering process, has some sort of something else they're working on. You know, some have very active businesses, some have jobs, some are trying to build consulting businesses, other ones content businesses. I think part of it is what draws them to me in the first place is that I'm like a workshop for entrepreneurship tools. Everything I'm working on is designed to consistently generate free agency. It's designed to continuously give people more and more leverage over their work. And that's what I'm trying to pass on to every single person that I collaborate with.
Can you explain for our listeners who don't know what you mean by a full stack freelancer?
Yes. So it's basically just moving from dependence on one income stream, whether that's a full-time job or it's self-employment, you know, traditional freelancing, to having a portfolio of income streams. And what makes that possible, seeing as we still only have 24 hours in a day, is the leverage and the reach and the scaling that technology gives us. You know, where you can have an online course that produces income while requiring little or none of your time and attention. Or you can have ebooks or downloadable PDFs. I mean, all sorts of ways that technology allows you to leverage your time and your knowledge. It's making passive income something that used to require millions of dollars to buy, like real estate, to something that can be created out of nothing, which is what computers allow us to do. Sit down at a computer and just, whether it's code or designs or writing or whatever, to just pour something out of your mind that can then be sold again and again all over the world.
Wow. So what are examples of that? You know, we talked about courses, we talked about self-publishing books. What are other digital things that individuals can crank out on their own?
Yeah, you know, it's really limited just by your imagination.
I realize the stupidity of the question as I asked it.
No, there is something subtle here, which is you don't want to collapse. I think a common mistake people make is collapsing the format with the content, right? So when you say ebook, the traditional paper book, that meant something. It meant, you know, this rectangular paper thing of a couple hundred pages with these things called chapters broken up into paragraphs with, like, it was defined for you. An ebook now, like, what is an ebook? The last ebook I published was an ebook with just my tweet storms. That's all it was.
People will pay money for an ebook of tweets.
Yeah, they'll pay me, you know, $5, which is not a lot. But considering that it was all stuff that I had produced, it was all just sitting on the internet. You know, you could publish an ebook full of mind maps. Let's say you're really good at creating mind maps of new things that you're learning. You could embed videos. I've seen ebooks where it's really just a photo, but then you tap it and if you're on a tablet, it takes you over to YouTube and plays a video. You could have links to downloadable PDFs. In my next ebook, I'm going to have links to Evernote note templates.
Wow. So just a container for ideas and things that happens to be bought on Amazon.
Yes, it's a container. And you know, people sometimes mention too, like, people don't read books anymore. But I say, yes, first of all, they do. And the thing with a book is you're creating an intentional environment, attentional and intentional, where when someone buys a book, they're entering a little world of your creation. So even if relatively few people buy it, let's say, and read it, the ones that do, by the time they finish spending, you know, however many hours to read your thing, and assuming they liked it, of course, they're a fan for life. They're yours. And that's not true of an article on Medium or a tweet, where it's just like, you know, you get one microsecond of attention and goodbye.
It shows how much the perceptions, like the stories we tell ourselves matter, because I have so much writing, right? I think I was counting unique blog posts. I think I've written like 75 in the past year, and I'm not willing to put them into an ebook yet because I was like, well, I want to have four chap sections, one on time, one on money, one on gender, one on productivity, but the gender section's light. So in two, like, they'll be balanced, you know? And so, like, I just made this completely fabricated excuse, right? That anchored to what the traditional understanding of a book, you know, with gigantic air quotes, is not really appreciating the fluidity of it's like people wouldn't be buying the Kahee book, right? It would be certain ideas that I write about.
Yeah. And, you know, get this. Did you know you can change the text of an ebook after it's been downloaded?
Oh, and the person who owns it will get it's like Google Docs for books, basically.
Yeah. You literally go onto Kindle. It's the Kindle Direct Publishing website. Upload a new Word document. And all the changes from it are propagated out to everyone who has an internet connection who's downloaded your book. So, like, it starts to become this point where maybe we have, imagine this for a second. I publish an ebook that's just the title. And then people can watch and follow along as I write each chapter.
Or they're buying a stream of thought, right? You could sell, like, different modules of your thoughts, right? It's like, here are my views on productivity. Here's my view on mortality. Like, which one do you want to buy?
Exactly. Yeah, you could have different combinations. You could really do both ways. This is kind of what I'm doing. My ebook, Design Your Work, was just a basically chronological ordering of my blog posts from 2014 to 2016. So that's essentially a stream of consciousness, just one after another. But then parts of those blog posts are being repurposed into other books that will be more structured and topical.
It is kind of like even the word book should be removed, right? It's just...
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just collections of ideas and packaged in whatever way people want to consume it, right? I guess that's what you have to find as a creator is how do people want to consume your ideas?
Exactly. And, you know, the medium is the message. You can have the same ideas. You know, developing subject matter expertise takes time. The learning itself is not scalable. It's the most unscalable thing there is. But once you have subject matter expertise, that you just go down the list of channels. You do mind maps, you do outlines, you do templates, you do webinars, you do podcasts, you do Instagram feeds, Snapchat feeds, automated email campaigns, online, like, actually I should do this, make a list of like 100 different manifestations for any given idea.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me of, I heard the CEO of, founder of Sweetgreen say this. I think he was paraphrasing Warby Parker. He said, we're experience focused, channel agnostic.
Yes.
And it was just like, holy shit, that is crystal clear.
Yes.
And it's something that a lot of people don't get.
Totally. And you know, one powerful thing around, you know, do you know, actually, I know you know him, David Perel.
Yeah.
He has this, his company is called North Star. He has a podcast as well. He talks about this, I think it's called his naked brands theory, which is that people are becoming brands and brands are becoming people. Right. So you have brands becoming people, you know, when the Wendy's Twitter account is funnier and more sarcastic than most actual humans.
Yeah, oh, that's so true.
But then people are becoming brands. I think like what you just said about having the same consistent experience across many, many, many different channels, that may sound daunting. Like, okay, we need a whole content marketing team. But a very easy way to do that, or at least a natural way to do that, is have your personality. You know, like who you are, which is, you know, pretty consistent, or at least, you know, coherent, be the experience that is consistent across all these channels.
Yeah, no, that's what we were talking about earlier. That's also where the design part can give you some leverage, right? Like each medium has its own constraints. And that's something that I have loved about this process, is that I naively went into podcasting saying like, well, I'm an interesting person who knows some interesting people. And I was like, wait a minute, but the experience is about how you ask questions and how you interview. And, you know, 52 weeks later, I may have figured it out, but that's the experience of the podcast, right? It's like, how good are you at asking questions around that same pool of ideas?
Yeah. And I'm sure your interviewing skills are now translating to other parts of your life.
Oh, without a doubt, like storytelling. So I need to ask you about, so you've set this up, 10 employees, courses, all these other business units, and now you're moving.
Yes. A few months ago, my fiance Lauren and I decided to move to Mexico. And the reasoning—
Are either of you Mexican?
She is Mexican American. So she has quite a bit of family there. And speak Spanish from, you know, growing up in a Mexican American household. My family is half Brazilian, and I lived for a time in Colombia, so I also speak Spanish. So it's actually not, in terms of, you know, moving overseas, it's not as crazy as it may seem. We both speak Spanish. We both lived in different countries, so really that aspect of it is not intimidating for us. What is new for both of us actually is making a living overseas. That's an entirely different proposition than, you know, surviving on student loans in South America.
And is that visa, like work visa issues, or more having the passive or the income streams set up that are portable?
Yeah. So really the reason I want to go is to test a hypothesis or a theory, which is that using specifically the productivity methods that we teach in Forte Labs, that one thing they enable you to do is to not just do work overseas. I think it's been well shown that it's feasible to be a digital nomad, to like be on your computer in a cafe in different countries. Like that no longer seems that out there. I think what is the edge now is, can you actually build something great? You know, whether that's intellectually, like, you know, writing a book, or whether it's something like building a business. I think that is still unclear. You know, you still have the startups, you know, moving from different parts of the world to Silicon Valley because they feel like they need to be physically bodily here to access the things they need to grow.
Although there would be companies like Automattic that makes, there are a handful of companies that are, is this more than a company being 100% remote?
So those companies, yeah, there's Buffer, there's Automattic, there is Zapier, there's GitHub. A lot of these companies that have gone remote. I mean, honestly, if they hadn't really publicized what they've been up to, I don't know if I'd have the courage to do this. But I think there's also something different where we are way, way smaller than any of them, right? Like we don't have millions of dollars to deploy. Where I want to show that even those very early, very sensitive stages, basically when we're an infant, you know, and a gust of wind could blow us over, that even then it's possible and actually really beneficial for a variety of reasons to have a completely remote arrangement, even from a developing country.
Is there anything beyond the intellectual exercise that is, can we create new types of companies that's spurring it? Maybe say like on the personal side?
Oh yeah, there's a whole bunch of things. I mean, one is I'm a little tired of the Bay Area. It's the most incredible place ever, but it just, there's some, you know, things about it that, like any place. So I wouldn't mind. I've been here 6 years, which is long for me. There is the fact that Lauren wants to eventually run for political office, specifically in Los Angeles, where she's from, in Wilmington, which is the port area. And she believes that she wants to learn Spanish because her voter base is going to be Spanish speaking. She speaks it already, but she wants to kind of perfect it. And that's really hard to do around here. Even in Mexico City, I think it's going to be challenging because everyone speaks English mostly from the professional class. So it'll be interesting. So there's that. There's wanting to live abroad before we have kids, which may happen in a few years. Just that the personal desire to like experience a new culture and experience a new place, which always, every single time I've done it, has had just a huge impact on my happiness, my creativity, my spiritual growth, personal growth. Like, I just love moving to new places. It's kind of my thing.
There's also research that that says that it slows down time.
Yes, yeah.
Things that are novel slow down time.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the system one, system two Kahneman stuff. When you wake up at 7 and you go to the coffee shop and you get on the train, your brain basically starts skipping frames. It goes from like an HDTV to like a GIFy, like an animated GIF, because it compresses. It's like, well, I know what's going to happen next, so let me just pull out like a chunk of the frame. And so you lose that richness. You basically lose like an HD life because the brain's just making shortcuts because it knows what's going to happen next.
Yeah, I really have noticed that myself. It's true. I was going to say, you know, half personal reasons, half sort of intellectual curiosity. I think the constraint or the thing that I'm watching closely, and actually this is one reason we're going to be centered in Mexico City to start. We're not at least initially going to do the backpacking thing where we're changing every few weeks. I really want to, you know, get probably a few month commitment down just because I want to be sure that I can run the business. And only once I see how that works and that it works, will we look at kind of jumping around to different cities.
Is it hard to get the legal elements of getting paid and work visas at a like 10,000 foot level?
You know, I really have no idea. Yeah, we bought the one-way tickets as our commitment device.
Yes.
And I'm actually going to be starting a series on my blog called Going Nomad, where I'm going to document in great detail. I'm going to go into the whole process, the thought process, the research process, all the decisions we're making, the planning, because I think one of the biggest things that's going to make this go mainstream is seeing examples, seeing case studies.
Where does that like sense of I need to see this in the world come from?
It's my evangelistic instinct. It's true. I was just talking about this with a friend. I've had this described as my superpower, where I'll just latch onto something and then I honestly don't really know what it is. I just become an outspoken evangelist because the prospect of keeping it to myself as some sort of secret, I just can't stand.
And what makes you so excited about it?
I don't know. I think it's just seeing someone adopt or take on something that you introduce them to and then seeing them get the benefits. As the meditation teachers always like to say, you know, it's the benefits. You want to get the benefits. or just, I don't know, seeing them make more money or have more independence or have more time to spend with their family. Those are the moments that just like make life worth living. Like that's the only reason any of this is even worth it. And that applies way beyond productivity. It applies to anything. Sometimes what changes your life is like, I got this new insulated cup. Having an insulated cup to keep my coffee hot, like really makes me happy.
Yeah. And I love that because it is about there's freedom, there's learning, there's the ability to be in new and novel situations and be uncomfortable. You know, it's appreciating that the like texture of life, right? I mean, I know I get that from our conversations and from kind of following your work.
Yeah, man. Thank you. Thank you for telling me that. It's I feed on those stories. Speaking of stories, it's just the privilege of being able to share knowledge and to teach and to make a difference in people's lives is the ultimate privilege, I think.
And that rounds back to our first point about expertise, right? There's a sense of duty that you can get around the expertise question, or like the expertise can be like buttressed or overpowered by the sense of duty and then being invested, you know?
Yeah.
And you just, yeah, I'm kind of butchering it a little, but there is something about, you know, being in service to others, right? Mm. And what is, you know, your vessel might be productivity, you know, but it's much more than that, right? It's like you said, you know, giving people the tools and the experiences. So it's definitely something it's something that you're living, and I'm excited to read the blog. We got a tiny move. We're moving to LA this summer for a couple of years.
Are you really?
Yeah. And
oh my gosh.
Similar thinking. Just see if this career, I'm using quotes, can be pursued somewhere outside. And I think with us, there's the additional constraint of, you know, two kids who need to be educated at some point. But it's kind of like, it's our test to see if this all works together.
Yes, it's a test. It's an experiment.
With I think I would say it on yours, I feel it on mine with very little downside.
Oh, yeah. Oh, of course. Yeah. Where in LA are you moving?
We're going to be moving to Manhattan Beach.
Oh my gosh.
Fulfilling a long held dream that I had, which is to wake up in the ocean every morning. I mean, this goes to the things that you teach. Like I bought the story that would only happen when I was like 59 and a half, you know, when my 401k kicked in.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, fuck that.
I know, seriously. That as I've been diving into digital nomad land online, just it's this crazy thing where we give up all our time to get money to get time. It's like it's as if we have all this lemonade and we trade it for some lemons so we can make lemonade.
And that's why they call it the hamster wheel.
Yeah, it really is. When you look at what things truly cost, when you question certain assumptions, for example, of location, you know, or what you can have or what you're allowed to have or what you deserve, what you're worthy of, you realize that actually there's not this ladder of experiences and of having a fulfilling life. It's just it's all available, just depending on what you're willing to challenge and take on.
Well, you have given us in this hour many, me personally, and I'm in this, many ways to think about it. You've inspired. And so, yeah, just this is a nice way to wrap up 52 weeks of a podcast with someone who made a bet early on me and was willing to get on a podcast that was, you know, self-produced. So thank you, man.
Of course. It's been a real pleasure and a real joy to see your growth, Kay. I think you're on an incredible trajectory, and I just can't wait to see what the rad family now becomes.
Well, maybe we'll see. Maybe I'll see you out in Baja, right?
Yeah, well, you know, we're going to be coming back to visit Lauren's family in LA, my family in Orange County, probably every month or so. So I will definitely, one-way flights are just $87 between Mexico City and LAX.
Oh, wow. Okay,
so like,
cool.
You know, it's easy.
But that's the irony. I was like, I might edit this part out, but that's the irony of it is that, look at that. Like, we're both leaving our homes and we're going to see each other more.
Yeah.
Right? Look at that. I mean, that's what happens when you go off the traditional path.
Exactly. It's possibilities.
Possibilities. Well, before we wrap, where we'll put it in the show notes, but where can our listeners go to find out all of the great things Forte Labs?
The home base is our website, which is Forte Labs, FORTELABS.co, not .com. That's really has links to everything else. And I'm most active on social media on Twitter. And my handle there is at Forte Labs.
Best of luck to you, Tiago. And I know we'll be hearing from you soon.
Thanks so much, Kay. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Rad Awakenings podcast. For more information on all things Rad, including our weekly email newsletter, please visit us at radreads.co. This podcast is a labor of love and funded by the community's generosity. And if you're interested in supporting us, please join us as a patron by visiting patreon.com/radreads. And of course, leaving a 5-star review always goes a long way. Thanks again, and until next time.